The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Pleasure and much excitement that I introduce our evening's moderator and organizer, writer Leslie Schwartz. Leslie and I have been planning and plotting tonight's program for some time in various Eastside coffee houses. Leslie's work with Homeboy was the subject of a very moving feature piece in the Los Angeles Times last October. I really recommend you look it up. It tells about her work there as a writer in residence. It's very beautiful. Leslie will be introducing tonight's other guests, including Father Gregory J. Boyle, the founder and executive director of Jobs for a Future, Homeboy Industries. Father Boyle formed Homeboy in 1992 as a response to the civil unrest in Los Angeles to create businesses that provide training, work experience, and above all, the opportunity for rival gang members to work side by side. Homeboy is a brilliant creation and a beacon of hope, and as I said, we hope that we'll be able to do many more events with them in the future. Leslie Schwartz is the author of two novels, and her nonfiction has appeared in numerous publications, including the Los Angeles Times, Poets and Writers, and Teachers and Writers. She teaches writing at various institutions of higher learning and in high schools and youth intervention agencies throughout East Los Angeles and Compton. For the last 2 years, she's taught creative writing at Homeboy Industries and is the managing editor of the newly established Homeboy Press and Literary Journal. And you'll also hear tonight from two poets who are working with Leslie on the Literary Journal, and you'll hear their reading as well. So Leslie will be introducing them, and we will proceed. Please welcome Leslie Schwartz, and have a great night. Thanks.
We have been plotting, haven't we, Louise? Thank you so much for inviting us tonight, and it's great to be up here and to see so many familiar faces in the audience and new faces too. I hope that as we're reading tonight, you'll, if anything sticks with you as the guys are reading, that you'll remember it and bring it up during the Q&A at the end of our readings and discussions tonight. So how's this going to work? We're all going to read something that we've written that has been inspired in some way by our work at Homeboy Industries. And right now what I think I'll do is I'll just say their names, and then I'll introduce them more fully when they come up to read. But, and if you guys will just wave so everybody knows who you are. This is Hector Verdugo. Of course, Father Greg. And on the end, there's Agustin Lizama. So I'm going to start, and I'm going to read from a book in progress. Before I start reading, I want to start with a quote that I found by Thomas Mann. It goes, "A writer is someone for whom writing is more difficult than it is for other people." And the reason I chose that tonight is that I had to put together three small, short, measly little pages, and I swear to you, it took me days to do this because I had to cut and paste from this nonfiction work that is a work in progress and a first draft, which is something I never share with anybody. So I'm breaking all these rules that I have. The way it's going to go, the reason I did this, I cut and paste, is that I wanted to take from the preface some information about Homeboy Industries, for those of you who aren't familiar with the organization. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about how I got involved in it, and then I wanted to tell a little anecdote that will hopefully sufficiently introduce my fellows up here on the stage tonight. So it's a little rough, but you'll get the idea. So I'll begin. Homeboy Industries originated in 1988 as a response to the loss of life that resulted from the proliferation of gangs in the Pico Aliso projects in East LA, which at that time had the highest concentration of gangs in the city. Back then, Father Gregory Boyle, a Jesuit priest, was pastor of Dolores Mission Church, which was situated at the epicenter of this growing violence. He and the mother of the barrio stepped in and tried to stop the bloodshed by providing the gang members with much-needed jobs, either at the church or with a few brave employers who were willing to take a chance employing unskilled youth from the neighborhood. Thus began the concept which would later underpin the entire philosophy of Homeboy Industries: nothing stops a bullet like a job. When the Homeboy Bakery was established a few years later, it provided a business where Father Greg could hire homies and give them a safe environment in which to learn job skills, allow them to make mistakes, and keep learning without the risk of getting fired. Since then, the nonprofit agency has added several businesses and dozens of educational, drug intervention, and life skills programs to its burgeoning organization. Today, Homeboy offers free programs like gang tattoo removal, mental health counseling, employment counseling, family support, legal services, and curriculum. But one of its most distinctive features is its small businesses, where the most difficult to place individuals are hired in transitional jobs. These jobs give the homeboys a safe, supportive environment in which to learn both concrete and soft job skills, while simultaneously building their resume and work experience. In placing rival gang members side by side in a work environment, Homeboy Industries also breaks down gang barriers as they learn mutual respect and genuine friendship. Now, I saw Celeste. Where are you? There she is. Okay. In 2006, I think that was the year, right, Celeste? Celeste Freeman, author of the fantastic book, I didn't write that, but I'm going to say it, G-Dog and the Homeboys, she and I implemented an oral histories project at Homeboy Industries. This project was funded by the California Council for the Humanities and Penn USA, and its basic premise was that we would teach creative writing and journalism skills to the homeboys and homegirls so that they could interview and record each other's stories for posterity. The project would culminate in an anthology and two public readings. When Celeste and I began the project, we hardly knew what we were getting ourselves into. What I did know was that all of us, no matter who we are, bring our own long-held narratives to the table with us. Whether these stories are true or not, helpful or harmful, we carry them around with us as a way to make sense of things. Like myths that explain to us the things we do not understand, we build a world of stories to make us feel safe. But often the stories that we unconsciously keep alive to hold our fear at bay also prevent us from being free. When I first met the homies and homegirls, they had all kinds of stories about themselves. Stories about their worthlessness, their pain, their suffering. Stories handed down to them by a culture that didn't care, by educational and judicial systems that chewed them up and spit them out, by addictions that kept them in a cycle of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and by prisons and violence that stole their dignity from them. Stories, in short, that they had internalized and believed to be true about themselves. But as the writing class progressed, I watched as the students began to unpack their old stories and write themselves into a new narrative. Soon they began to arrive at a deeper truth about themselves. With poetry, they interrogated their false beliefs and excavated the value of their own worth. They wielded their words like swords and fought a different sort of battle than those they once waged on the streets and within themselves. Using poetry, they discovered that what they once thought to be true about themselves was not only a lie, but a tether to darkness and sorrow. Through poetry's patient teaching came hope. Father Greg says nothing stops a bullet like a job. I would like to add that nothing stops a bullet like a poem. The night of the culminating reading for the Oral Histories Project, something happened that changed me forever. But first, a little backstory. When Augustine was 12 years old, he was badly injured in a drive-by shooting. The bullet grazed his head, hit the phone booth where he was talking on the telephone, and ricocheted back into his left hand, tearing it to pieces. The loss of that hand became for him, as he once said, both his power and his poison. I'll never forget the moment at the reading when Augustine first went up to the mic. Because of the injury to his hand, he wasn't able to hold both the mic and the anthology that contained his poems at the same time. After a moment of trying to negotiate both things at once, Hector, without saying a word, walked up to the stage and stood by Augustine's side, holding the magazine open for him so he could read his published work to the gathered crowd. Here were two men who might have once been considered enemies on the street, acting as brothers beneath the spotlight of poetry. What struck me most was that although Augustine alone authored those poems, he could not have given them voice that night without Hector's help. Now that is a beautiful thing. Both a powerful lesson in love and respect, and indisputable evidence that writing indeed restores us to ourselves and renews our obligations to one another. Augustine told everyone that night that poetry gave him back his soul. Literature yielding to courage, poetry harvesting trust and community. Ladies and gentlemen, Augustine Lezama.
I just want to say real quick that when I first met Leslie, I didn't even know what poetry was, right? To me, I thought it was a book or something like that. But as I got to know her, she's really impacted my life. And I just want to show you guys what she was talking about. When I was 12 years old, this is what happened to me. So a 12-gauge shotgun pretty much shattered my left hand, and I ripped it into pieces. But today this is my power today. Today, this is me now. You mean today I'm not ashamed of it no more. And through poetry, I could stand here in front of you guys today and show you guys my hand. Before, I wouldn't have been able to do that. But thanks to Leslie, and I just want to say this to her real quick, that to me, I feel like a rich man to know her, just to have her in my life. So thank you, Leslie. Here goes one of my first pieces that I wrote while I was in Leslie's class. It's called Cold October. I was 12 years old. It was a cold October night of 1991. There I was, a young, innocent child, talking on the payphone to a really good friend. I didn't see it coming. I wish every day of my life I would have. I didn't even hear it coming. All I felt was fire roaring through my left skinny hand and a car serving off to my left, then rolling away through the dark street. And then my skinny little body hit the dark street with a loud, painful, burning scream coming out of my tiny little mouth. That's when my ugly journey of gangs, hurt, pain, anger, deceive, harming others, and lies all got started. So that's my first one I wrote, so... Here's my second one. This is I'm writing this. As I'm writing my poems, I'm transforming my life, and I'm really healing from my life because I'm going back to what I really went through, and I'm writing it through my poetry. So I just wanted to tell you guys that. But here it goes. It's Confused in the Alley. It all started in an alley of Isabel Street. 36 of us, young, stubborn, prideful, neglected, abusive, young, gifted teenage adults. Experiencing rejection by our own families. Society looking down on us with disappointed faces. Looking toward us, worthless to the world, as they call it. Judgment being used for our bald heads, tattoos, baggy pants, and whatever our culture desires. Whatever it happened to, it's a free country bullshit. Lost looking for hugs, lost, looking for acceptance, till we finally got it in this alley of lost souls, where pain is enraged with anger, and anger is triggered to violence. The year was 1991, stuck in this chaotic war zone. Every day was the 4th of July, wounded with no remorse. A 12-gauge shotgun shattering the fragments of a 12-year-old little boy's left hand. Houses getting sprinkled with high-tech submachine guns, not carrying the assistance of children and parents. Drive-by shootings in style. And gunshots roaring rivers of bloodstream throughout these immense blocks of Los Angeles. Where so many souls want to be set free. Where so many lost souls want to be heard. I was just a 12-year-old, not even in puberty, lost in this chaos of roach-infested gang cruelty violence. As the years went by, more souls disappearing one at a time. Rains pouring, mass murders louder in this gang-infested air in the streets of LA. As the years went by, some of the 36 met the destinations of the deaths of death. Some stuck in the prison dungeons of hell for the rest of their lives. All I can say is thank you for the precious, painful acceptance, delinquent memories. I would always savor them with dignity. You would always be remembered as the great human souls you were and not the filthy dirt society thought you were. Now, even though there's two of us left today, it was a pleasure serving with you, man, in this chaotic war zone. This is where it all started, in the alley of lost souls, where pain is enraged with anger. And anger was triggered to violence. This last poem is very special. I want to dedicate this poem to a special man in my life. My only father I've ever known. A man I treasure, I admire, I respect and honor and love. With all my heart, Father Grape Oil. It's called Vision. It started with a vision of compassion, a vision of unconditional love, a vision that everybody's important, a vision to reconstruct the broken down and lost. Because of your vision, you have made the impossible possible. You have brought hope to the hopeless. And the most important of all, you have brought light to my darkness. Thank you for the miracles you have brought into my life, my pops. Father G, I thank God every day for sending you down my way. Thank you, pops. I love you. So before I leave the stage, I just want to say that today I'm a prime living example that change is possible. Because of one man's vision, I'm standing here today in front of all of you. But I just want to leave you guys with this note real quick so you guys could envision this. And hopefully, I don't know if it could touch some of you guys, and hopefully you guys could be open-hearted to what's out there in our neighborhoods and stuff like that. But just imagine, because of one man's vision, all the lives he's transforming, including mine. Imagine what we could do with all of our visions, putting them together, what we could really do in our neighborhoods. I just want to thank you guys for hearing me, and thank you once again.
Augustine, you always make me cry. It reminded me of this one day when I was gone for a couple of weeks from Homeboy, and I came back, and I was talking on the phone to my husband and on the cell phone, and this was when we were on First Street in Boyle Heights, and I felt this it was all glass windows, the cleanest glass windows you'd ever see. They'd clean them all day long. And I felt this imperceptible kind of pushing towards the glass. And I was on the phone, and I said, you know, I got to call you back. And I hung up the phone, and a bunch of the homeboys just started coming out with, and Augustine leading the pack with their poems. You've got to look at, not hello, not how have you been. You've got to look at this poem I wrote. And I remember I had to go, it's not very far, it's like from here to the back of this room to get, I had a meeting and I had to get to the back. And so it takes, you know, 30 seconds to walk back there. It took me like 2 hours. And everywhere I stopped along the way, somebody had a poem to show me. And I remember thinking by the time I got halfway there that they were literally carrying me to the back of the room on their words. It was just the most beautiful, surreal feeling. Anyway, so Hector is coming up next. And I just want to tell you, say one brief thing about Hector. Hector and I did this radio show, I don't even remember, like last year, I think. And, you know, I heard some amazing stuff that I'd never known about Hector while he was talking to, it was Dick Gordon's The Story, I think it was called. And, you know, I have this idea that poetry and language is so important that it stretches for all the way out across the universe. And, there's a story I have that proves this to be true. So a few weeks ago I was in Iowa teaching, and I got an email from a former student at Iowa who said that, and I'd had her like 3 or 4 years ago, and she wrote me this email. She said, you know, I wanted to come again this year, and your class was full. And then I thought, you know, I haven't written in 3 years, and I'm a total loser, and I'll never write again. And I wanted to write again, and I just feel like such a loser. And then I was in my car, and I prayed, you know, I wanted to come back, and I prayed to God, show me a sign. And by the way, she's in Minnesota. Show me a sign if I should continue this writing thing or not. And then she said, all of a sudden, the radio came on. She must have turned it on. I don't know if God does that. But the radio came on, and she heard Hector and me from a recorded story months ago. And she said, I heard Hector's story, and I heard him talk about writing. And I decided then and there that I needed to come back to Iowa. And so I'm coming back this year. 3,000 miles or whatever, 2,500 miles, the words go across and they touch other people's lives. Hector Verdugo.
What's up, you guys? Well, you know what? I was going to do the first poem that I wanted to read was... It was from my compadre, Joseph Holguin, who, great person, funny, oh man, he's just the funniest guy, man. And going through the trials of life, you know, especially in the life of the darkness of gangster stuff and drugs and stuff. But he wrote this one. It's called Clinging to the Cracks of His Father's Broken Heart. Hopefully I'll read it right. Pulling back on a plunger, sucking up any compassion of life or love that's left in my body. Pushing down and waiting to feel the warmth that will be my ticket out of the pain and sorrow that has smothered me for most of my life. All the pain and all the anguish slowly fading into heaven, but that's not the heaven I can keep. This too will slowly fade, and I wake to the nightmare I've been living. Broken needles forced into the skin of my forearm. Desperately searching for a vein to puncture. Nobody cares is what I say to myself over and over again. Just another excuse not to deal with what's been holding me down for all these years. Emptiness swallows me whole, blood running down my arm like a tear on my mother's face, reconfirming her own thoughts of failure, reinflicting the pain and abuse my father once laid upon her. Now dead from the same poison I yearn for. Memories running through my head like blood through the river of my veins. Nothing left to live for is a thought that invades my mind like soldiers in a foreign country, reeking of broken promises, dirty stairwells, and nights that never end. Sickness interrupted. Sunlight embraces my face of thoughts of my own children, flutter through my mind like butterflies on a sunny day. New hope found in a child, clinging to the cracks of his father's broken heart. Joseph Ogie. All right, this is one of the first poems that I wrote with Leslie. Leslie's opened up this crazy new world to me. You know the words and all these creative thoughts starting to come in my head. She's teaching me, like, this is the way, and I'm listening to some of the poetry, and she brings in some of Luis Rodriguez's poetry and stuff, and he just started to, like, wait a minute, hold on. I started writing here and there and just getting inspired, and you know, she's like, oh, that's great, that's great. I said, this lady's lying, man. She's lying. She's just, you know. And then I started to believe it. I said, wait a minute, you know what I mean? It does sound kind of feed, man. I said, holy shit. But and then after, like I said, you know, let me try to get a little bit more into this. I'm not giving myself the chance. And I started getting more into it, and then, man, this is one of the first, like, long poems that I wrote. Usually it was just like a couple lines and stuff. It's called Warning Sign. I give you fair warning. It's time my people come out of mourning. Mourning from body of warfare, police brutality, and shitty schools. You use drugs, media, and psychology as your oppression tools. But like the cucaracha, we become immune to your poison. We're still multiplying, filling your cities, states, country. Shaking off the foggy haze you left us in for so long. That shit was so wrong. But now the giant awakes. Let's see how long it takes for brown faces to be head of board meetings, get preferable seatings, leading the pack without the cheatings, seen as believing. So take heed to my warning to all those who will listen. Grind your teeth and have your fit while our skin just glistens as the light shines upon the brown ones. Not just brown in tone, but brown in heart. Because we all know our complexion ranges from light to dark. Oh yeah, from the color of lamb's wool to the darkness of molasses. Hear me, O ye oppressor, while I speak to the masses. Damn, you say as you sit back and think, were not these the peasants supposed to be extinct? Not by blood, but extinct in the mind, through our education, with all the lies we can find. Oops, someone dropped the ball. Now it's in my court. Please allow me to retort. You had me fooled for quite some time, had us thinking we were inferior, low class, and you superior, with your whip in hand, supposed ruler of my land. Homeboy, you just don't understand. We've reigned for thousands of years while you were living in caves. We built pyramids with tears. It's our history you've tried to smear, and it's my people you actually fear. Well, it was one sign. All right, I'm going to switch it up a little. I wrote this other one. It's kind of short, but I said I never really read it out loud to a bunch of people, so I might as well read it right now. You know? I never named it or anything. I just wrote it down. I stare at you right into your eyes and try not to get mad. Please don't use the excuse of not being raised by your dad or tell me about the shit you never had. Today's a new day, and you're alive. You should be glad. Don't you listen to them freaking voices that drag you down. Look at you. You're intelligent. You're handsome. And thank God, you're brown. Your dreams are still in your reach. Your kids look at you waiting for you to teach. This is one contract you absolutely cannot breach. So what's up? You ready for today? Again, I need to remind you about them voices that discourage and bring doubt. Don't trip on them. They have no say, so they have no clout. You keep your head up, and I, the one who really knows, you have the greatest potential to obtain all dreams, to reach all goals. I know you have the will. Believe me, it shows. So look alive, my brother. As I'm staring into a mirror, I feel kind of funny. I grab my cell phone and some money. I'm off to work. All right. Here's another one. Born fresh with water to grow, delicate flesh that's in need of nourishment and influence. My vine grown in an alley where winos piss and dogs sniff. As I grow, I'm mixed inside with sour and sweet. I'm a grape yearning to be wine. Squash me, see my soul. My flesh spills its juices. Let it stand exposed, rotting for all to see. I sit still, marinating in ghetto air. I fill your glass, sip me. Let me overwhelm your palate with my exotic flavor. Taste my rage mixed with honor and passion. Swish me in your mouth and taste a hint of humility, love, and hate. Swallow and feel me instantly intoxicate your soul. My potent wine will allow you to feel things that you haven't felt before and see things you might not have seen before. Share me with the opposite sex, and I'll take you to erotic peaks you have not been before. Drink me among associates, and I will expose wolves disguised as sheep. Sit me amongst friends and family, and renew your soul with love and laughter. You will wish not for the night to end. You're intrigued by my color, deep red, and my exotic flavor and potency. You wouldn't dare call me an insignificant bottle of wine. My label says 1974, the ghetto of Los Angeles, from an alley where winos piss and dogs sniff. Nah, 32. Oh, I don't know how I'm gonna do this without the cursing, you guys. Close your ears, kids. Sorry. This is called a plan. Ghetto prophecies turn dry. We shall overcome. When? You know, a friend of mine got 25 with an owl for stealing baby shoes. A drug addict with a history of mental abuse. Fucking baby shoes? They need to put that shit in the news. Justice, it's as rare as shark fin soup in East LA. Another drug addict with his life to pay. Filling their prison system while that system is filling their pockets. Justice, bitch, where you at? You took a vacation, no telling when you'll be back. Have you seen Iraq? Halliburton, them and the mother crews. They know the plan. Next stop, Iran. Babies cry and kids scream as a Yankee drops more bombs for the team. Not raids innocent in sweet dreams, waking up nightmares so obscene, can't comprehend how can this be. Afghanistan, the opium land. Back to business, baby. We took care of the Taliban. Let's get that heroin back to U.S. land so we can get fools to steal baby shoes, oblivious and don't understand. It's all part of a big plan. That's it. I'm done.
You know, he didn't believe me when I told him he knew how to write. I had to prove it to him somehow. This went on for so long. But he knows how to write, right? So our final reader tonight is Father Greg. He's going to be reading from his soon-to-be New York Times best-selling book. It's not out yet, though. But I'm convinced. It's called Tattoos on the Heart, Parables and Stories from the Barrio. And I just want to say that I've had the distinct honor and privilege of reading this book cover to cover. And I haven't told you this, but that this book, I've read it a few times now. I'm helping him with some of the typos and stuff. Not very many, though. There's not very many. And You know, every time I read it, I cry, and then I laugh, and then I cry, and then I laugh, and it's like I'm reading it over for the first time each time. But the thing about this book that's so profound to me is that, you know, any time during the period that I've been looking at it, that I felt like I just couldn't, you know, those days, you just can't get up. You don't want to go out. You don't want to do it. You know, the whole drill. And I would read this book and be filled with such hope and joy. And, you know, these guys talk a lot about how Father Greg, you know, changed their lives. And, you know, he changed my life too by giving me the opportunity to stick around. He never kicked me out. I'm still there. You can't get rid of me. And now this book, you know, it's like, it's not just what's happening here in Los Angeles, but this book will be out there. And I predict that it's going to change lives across the, what did you say, the Caribbean? Was that what you said earlier tonight? Across the world. So without further ado, Father Greg.
Thank you very much, Leslie. Thank you for your guidance, not just with the book, but with these characters and at Homeboy. I will never get tired of saying that it is the privilege of my life to know Dean Dean and Hector and the thousands that I've employed this week at Homeboy Industries. Yeah, I just wanted to see if Mona in my development office was still there. I'm not accustomed to reading anything. I've never read anything. I don't want to read anything. I've told, yeah, I think I have like 250 stories or vignettes or whatever in this book. I've never read them to anybody. I've spoken them at homilies and all sorts of other talks and things, so I'm unaccustomed to that. But anyway, this is the end of the third chapter, which is a chapter tentatively called Tender Mercy. The chapters are kind of thematic, loosely. I'm just trying to find a home for the stories, and they weave together sort of with Leslie's help. And it's mainly a story about the toxicity of shame and disgrace as sort of key in the gang experience. You know, the principal suffering of the poor throughout history is not that they couldn't rustle up enough money to pay their rent, or they were just $2 short of buying a package of Pampers. The principal suffering of the poor is shame and disgrace. And that you somehow want to find this our common task in kinship is to dismantle those messages of shame and disgrace and replace them with the truth. And so this is the end of this chapter that treats basically of that theme. And as I've never found a microphone I didn't like, but until I had to actually read something that I've written, so bear with me. The only reference that I want to make, I'll mention the camps that I'm at. I'm in 25 different detention facilities where I do Catholic services, and it mentions a camp, and that's one of the 24 camps, probation camps in the county. Often after Mass at the camps, kids will line up to talk one-on-one. The volunteers sometimes invite the minors to confession, but usually the kids just want to talk, be heard, get a blessing. At Camp Afrolabal, I'm seated on a bench outside in a baseball field, and one by one, the homies come over and talk briefly. This day, there's quite a lineup. The next kid approaching, I can tell, is all swagger and pose. His walk is chingon in its highest gear. It's the most exaggerated cholo stroll, his head bobbing side to side to make sure all eyes are riveted. He sits down, we shake hands, but he seems unable to shake the scowl etched across his face. "What's your name?" I ask him. "Sniper," he sneers. "Okay, look," and in parentheses I write, "at this point I've been down this block before, I have a feeling that you didn't pop out of your mom and she took one look at your ass and said, 'Sniper.'" "So come on, dog, what's your name?" Gonzalez. He relents a little. Okay, now, son, I know the staff here will call you by your last name. I'm not down with that either. Tell me, Mijo, what's your mom call you? Cabrón. There is even the slightest flicker of innocence in his answer. Oye, no cabe duda, but son, I'm looking for birth certificate here. The kid softens. I can tell it's happening, but there is embarrassment and a newfound vulnerability. Napoleon. He manages to squeak out, pronouncing it in Spanish. Wow, I say, that's a fine, noble, historic name. But I'm almost positive that when your jefita calls you, she doesn't use the whole nine yardas. Come on, mijo. Do you have an apodo? What's your mom call you? Then I watch him go to some far distant place, a location he has not visited in some time. His voice, his body language, and whole being are taking on a new shape right before my eyes. Sometimes, his voice so quiet, I lean in. Sometimes, when my mom's not mad at me, she calls me Napito. I watch this kid move, transform from sniper to Gonzalez to Cabron to Napoleon to Napito. We all just want to be called by the name our mom uses when she's not pissed at us. Names are important. After all, the main occupation of most gang members most of the time is the writing of their names on walls. I recall on my first day of teaching at Loyola High School in Los Angeles in 1979, I was scared poopless about the prospect. With my arms filled with books, juggling the necessary cup of coffee, I walked to my first class on my first day. I stop in the doorway of a veteran teacher, Donna Wanland. She's at her desk reading the Morning Times. It's my first day of teaching, I say to her. Give me some advice. Two things, she says. One, know all their names by tomorrow. Two, it's more important that they know you than that they know what you know. Good advice. I followed it, and I think it served me in good stead. I remembered it when I arrived at Dolores Mission. Once I had made the decision to not be a slave to my office, I wandered the projects, often approaching uninvited. The various groupings of gang members which spotted every corner and crevice of the housing developments. The reception was almost always chilly. This changed only after I began to visit homies from the community who were locked up or wounded in the hospital. This would eventually thaw what had been indeed icy up to that point. There was one kid in particular who everyone knew as Cricket. To say that he would give me the cold shoulder would impugn shoulders. Cricket, 15 years old, would walk away when I approached and would return to the bola, I noticed, once I left. I investigated and discovered his name was William. I walk up to this group of gang members with Cricket among them, and he doesn't disappear on me. I shake hands with all of them, and when I get to Cricket, he actually lets me shake his hand. William, I say to him, how you doing? It's good to see you. William says nothing. But soon I leave. I always made a point of not staying very long. As I walk away, I can hear William in a very breathy, age-appropriate voice say to the others, hey, the priest knows my name. I've called you by your name. You are mine, is how Isaiah gets God to articulate this truth. Who doesn't want to be called by name or known? It would seem to be the initial step toward dissolving pervasive toxicity in those who have seen their me virtually wiped out. The knowing and the naming seem to get at what Anne Lamott calls our inner sense of disfigurement. That for as misshapen as we feel ourselves to be, attention from another reminds us of our true shape in God. I give credit for most of my gray hairs to a kid named Speedy. He was a thrill seeker in the world of project gangbanging, and I don't mean that in a good way. He was Evel Knievel, pulling off near-death-defying stunts, creeping into enemy territory, just so that he could, as it were, stick his thumbs in his ears, loll his tongue, and say neener, neener, neener at a bowl of vatos that hated him in a big way. More than a few times, I'd see him attempt one of these stick-your-head-in-the-lion's-mouth moments, and I'd chase his ass back to his barrio, screaming at him, red-faced, saying things my mother never taught me. Are you fucking out of your mind? Do you want to get killed? I'm in the sacristy at Dolores Mission, and per usual, I'm late for the 5 p.m. Mass. My glances out to the body of the church catch viejitas looking at their watches, struggling at each other. I'm vesting as fast as I can. Speedy enters the side door. He's a lanky guy at 17, rail thin but taut, from no doubt being pursued by enemies all the time. He slides his two elbows on the Formica countertop and perches his chin on his fists. I'm flipping through books to find the readings. You know, G, he begins, I don't really care if I live or die. I'm embarrassed to admit all I'm thinking of are the three old ladies who were waiting for 20 minutes for the Misa to start. Look, dog, I tell him, throwing a Guatemalan stole over my head, I have to do Mass right now. It's going to have to do for the moment for you to know that I care whether you live or die. Speedy weighs this on some internal scale and things balance. Okay, he says. And I think the equivalent of phew. 3 hours later, I'm sitting at my desk. In my pastor days, I kept the front door of the parish office open, giving you a clear shot of my inner office and my desk. Speedy appears, and his mood seems elevated, and he dives right in. Look, I don't want you to get red at what I'm about to tell you. This, of course, begins the reddening process for me. What you do, I ask as he stands at the side of my desk, ready to rabbit jump out of my office if my red face turns explosive. Well, I walked Anna home. Red face at morning, sailor, take warning. I'm pissed. Anna is a very cute homegirl that Speedy is currently sprung on, and she lives in the heart of Speedy's worst enemies. I mean, they really hate him. To walk her home was to endanger his and her life. It was unconscionable and irresponsible, and my face was flammable. I don't get to put words to my displeasure because Speedy rapid-fires the rest of the story to me. He deposits Anna in her second-story apartment, and as he is descending the stairs, he encounters eight members of the dreaded rival gang. They aren't displeased to see him. They're salivating. They chase him and throw whatever they can at him, rocks, sticks, empty bottles of 40-ouncers. Had this story happened 5 years later, they would have had guns. He eludes them, leaving them in the project dust. They don't call him Speedy for nothing. As he nears First Street and can see the relative safety of his barrio across the street, he bumps into Yolanda, a woman active in the parish. She knows enough to know that Speedy should not be where he currently is. She summons him. Ven, mijo, ¿qué está haciendo aquí? Speedy, out of breath and panting, lowers his head. ¿Sabes qué, mijo? She says. Te digo una cosa. If anything happened to you, it would break my heart in two. She barely knows him. You know, I've seen you playing with your nephew in the park. What a good deal you are. I've also seen you feed the homeless at the church. What a generous and good thing that is. Then she returns to her earlier refrain, even with even more resolve soaked in it. Pero te digo una cosa. If anything happened to you, it would break my heart in two. Now vete a la casa. Speedy arrives at my office, out of breath from this encounter with a nearly perfect stranger. He looks at me and smiles after the telling of this tale. You know, he says, tapping his heart with his finger, that shit made me feel good. Of course it did. But what could be tinier in the scope of human relations than the tender mercy of the stranger, rubbing salve on the wounds of this kid's hopeless heart. You can almost hear the armor fall away and clank to the ground. Not long after this, things started to change for Speedy, largely because he wanted them to. As Richard Rohr would say, he had decided to live his way into a new way of thinking. He married his, if not childhood sweetheart, his teenage one, Claudia. They moved away from the projects, and Speedy began work in an oil refinery in Richmond, California. They began a family and now have three kids, an older daughter and two boys. When Claudia had her first child, it was the summer of the movie Free Willy, and she was so tiny and hugely and preposterously pregnant, Willy became my nickname for her. I called her on her birthday once. "Happy birthday, Willy," I tell her when she answers the phone. "Gee, you remembered." "So," I ask her, "what's your Ruko got planned for tonight?" "Oh," she gets quiet. "You know, money's tight, and well, we're just gonna stay home tonight." "What? No me digas," choosing to exaggerate wildly. "Oye, put that cheap gold on the phone." Speedy steps up to the receiver. "I can't believe you, dog," I start in on him. "I mean, you can't squirrel away 20 bones to just take her out and eat by candlelight, tú sabes, whispering in her ear, mi vida, mi reina, mi cielo, mi todo. Qué gacho right there." Speedy thinks for half a beat. "Damn, I bought her ass roses. What more she want?" I can visualize Claudia laughing and hugging her man. The two of them falling into each other's arms, holding on against the darkness and witnessing together real light, real peace. Speedy, whose real name is Ramon, hailed from a family broken in all the usual ways. As a kid, he had to navigate alcoholism, fighting, estrangement, and inappropriateness on top of dysfunction stacked high onto sadness. As he's built a life for his own family, he's negotiated the landmines that got regularly detonated during his own childhood. One day he's in town and invites me to dinner. "I'll even pay," he says. At the restaurant, we talk of his job, his return to school, of his greater responsibility and newfound leadership role at the oil refinery. I ask about downtime and what he does on Sunday. "Well," he's ready to go into detail, "we begin with mass. Then we head off to Mimi's Cafe. The kids can order whatever they want. We always go there. Then we go to Barnes & Noble every Sunday for 2 hours. Now, you know my cheap ass is not going to buy any books. No, everyone picks out the book they want, and we all go to our separate corners. They'd be having comfortable chairs there at Barnes & Noble. And then when time's up, we put the books back. We don't sweat it. We'll be back next Sunday. Pick up right where we left off." I laugh and am both charmed and astonished. "You know, the kids did beg me to buy the new Harry Potter book," he continues. "So what the hell, I broke down and bought it. Now you know what we do every night? I sit in my recliner. We turn off the TV and my three kids read Harry Potter out loud. First my oldest, my daughter, she reads a whole page. Then she hands it to my son, and he reads a paragraph. Then the baby, with help from the other two, reads a sentence, but barely. And it gets passed back. You know, page, paragraph, sentence. And I," he starts to buckle and his voice trembles, "I just close my eyes, sitting in my recliner, listening to my kids read out loud." Speedy puts his hands up to his eyes, tearful, and is as surprised as I am where this story has taken him. I reach over beyond his plate of a steak half eaten and grab his arm. "You've got a good life," I tell him. The tears arrive now in their fullness, unencumbered and welcome even. "Yeah," he looks at me. Yeah, I do. Out of the wreck of our disfigured, misshapen selves, so darkened by shame and disgrace, indeed the Lord comes to us, disguised as ourselves. And we don't grow into this. We just learn to pay better attention. That no matter whatness of God breaks through the toxicity of shame, and tender mercy holds us as never before. Favorable, finally, and called by name by the one your mom uses when she's not pissed off. Thanks. Testing.
Thank you, Greg. That was beautiful. Can you hear me? Is this on? Yeah. So we were asked to have a discussion up here. And I think, you know, my gut is telling me, let's just open it up for some questions. And we'll just have a discussion off of that. So anybody have any comments or questions? Yes.
I'd just like to ask Hector and Augustine how you first felt when you saw your names in print.
When it's not on court papers? It was great. I mean, man, you know, look at us, you know. From cholos to poets. I had a screenplay about this stuff. It's. I mean, wow, you know? I mean, we come from a different world. This is not our world, you know? And Father G opened up this new, you know, this new world to us through Homeboy Industries. And here we are, get to experience life. With, like, it was kind of like, it was meant to be this way. But for whatever messed up reason, we didn't have it that way, you know? And Pops, again, he brings us in, and great people like Leslie and the staff at Homeboys show us something totally different. And here we are now. We learn, you know? I got my GED through Homeboys, and Father G's putting me through college now, and it's like, look at this new stuff, you know? You open up a book and there's my name. Oops.
Well, as for me, I don't know. I can't speak out the words what it meant when I first saw it. To me, I'm very grateful to really have this opportunity again to actually to think of myself that I am somebody now in society. I mean, that I could actually look beyond my block, that I only used to look forward to, and I would have died for it. You mean, just to see and experience what's really out there. And to me, I'm just very grateful and flattered, and I would always say a million thank yous just to, and look at me now. I mean, I would have never thought I would be out here in front of an audience just sitting out my poems and stuff like that. I mean, to me, this is a dream come true, so that's the way I feel about that. Thank you.
Yes.
I think you should have warned us to bring tissue. Wanted to ask about the transformation of East LA, especially with all the new, you know, new construction, new housing. Is Aliso Pico even still there? And how has that affected
the gang wars and everything else. And then also you're in Chinatown now, right?
Yeah, you know, the Homeboy Industries was born 20 years ago in the housing projects, which was very densely populated, had 8 gangs, half of them at war with each other, one African-American set and the others Latino. And it was born to help or give alternatives to gang members to redirect their lives for the members of those 8 gangs. Then we moved to our second location at 1848 East 1st Street. And then suddenly we found that all these gang members from the gangs in the Hollenbeck Police Precinct, nearly 40, 10,000 gang members, would come to that office seeking the same kinds of things, services, jobs, then eventually tattoo removal. Then we moved to our third location. That's where Leslie first started to come to our office in, at 1916 East 1st Street. And suddenly it was the whole county. So people connect us with East L.A., and though, you know, the three of us live in East L.A., but it's we really do serve the county. 1,000 people, folks a month walk through our doors, 45 different zip codes. There are 1,100 gangs in L.A. County with 86,000 gang members, members from as nearly as we can tell, I suspect it's probably larger if you include tagging crews. Nearly 600 different gangs, their members have come through to get thousands and thousands and thousands of them. You know, 4,000 laser treatments a year for tattoo removal, on and on. 5 business, lots of employees, more than we currently have money for. So, but we've been in that position before. So, now we're all roads lead to us in the sense that we're over on Alameda and Bruno, which is just 2 blocks from Union Station and Placito Olvera. And so when I go to the camps, and occasionally they'll say, but they don't say it anymore because I give the same pitch about, it's too far. Couldn't you start something in the valley? And I said, far is good, you know. Far from what? Enemies, neighborhood, trouble. Take the red line or the blue line or the purple line. All lines lead to us. And so that's kind of the idea. So we're in a neutral location and we're far from trouble. And the best way to deliver intervention services, it seems to me, is outside of the community in which the gang members live.
Yeah. Right here in the back.
Right behind you there. The microphone's right there.
Hector was mentioning how the homeboys really come from different worlds. And my question is, how do you guys negotiate the different languages of conventionally written world, like the language that most students of writing come across in published novels and poems, and then the sort of bilingual, hybridized, curse-filled language that you might find in the homeboy's world? Like, how do you give a homeboy something to read where he could recognize a voice like his own?
If you don't mind, I'll and then they can talk about what the experience is like for them. But, you know, when I come into the class, you know what? Great literature is great literature. And they negotiate it fine. They get it, you know? And I'd like to bring in, you know, culturally relevant literature, but I'll bring in, you know, Thomas Mann or, you know, some of the old dead white guy poets, and they still respond to it. Because when you bring in great language, you know, it touches our hearts. And we'll tear a poem apart in the class before we even start writing. And their insights into it, you know, they're right on it. I don't know if they have that same experience. It seems to me that's the experience. Maybe I'm delusional, but I don't know. Seems okay to me.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Any questions? Okay, right
yep.
here.
Yep. No.
It's really nice to meet some poets. I was wondering if you two guys would recommend me some of the poets that really inspired you.
Some of the poetry, well, I'm like I said, I wasn't a poet or nothing like that. You know, we came into homeboys and here we go into this craziness of words and expression and stuff like that. And then Leslie started bringing in, of course, all these different poets, but the one that I'm going to relate to is Luis Rodriguez, who's from San Gabriel Valley and grew up in the barrios and found his way out of it through writing, what kept him alive and, you know, clinging to wanting to be alive. I hear some of his poetry and I say, yeah, all right, that's cool. That's what I like. You know, I mean, there's some, if I could say it right, like sophisticated words with, boom, some down and dirty words that I understand. And you put them in, you put them all in one bowl and mix them up and ooh, that's good. You know what I mean? So hopefully that helps both of you guys. Questions.
Well, as for me, like I said, like since the beginning, I really didn't know what poetry was. And when Leslie started talking about writing and she started teaching us, like, the only thing I really used to know about writing is writing a letter when I was in prison to my girlfriends and stuff. So, but I think one of the poets that gets me and that I recognize and that I like, that I love to read, is Pablo Montero. To me, I think he's fascinating. He's very old school, very. Just a lot of stuff he reads, it just catches me in. So.
Oh my goodness, see, this gets hard after a while. Yes, right here, yeah.
Hi, Gregory.
Hi, Catherine.
What is your greatest need, Greg? If you could wish for something to help you in your ministry.
I'm just looking at the woman who raises money for me over
well,
there.
Well, I know money's one of them.
Yeah.
But I know money's one of
the
them.
The lottery and but that kind of thing. But
do you have a need for businesses to hire your people?
Absolutely. I mean, the largest thing, especially right now, is we have sort of a hiring freeze with 500 employees.
Yes.
And looking to chisel that down a little bit.
I don't mean for you to hire them. Do you have other businesses downtown boys?
We have job developers whose job is to locate gainful employment for folks. But again, you know, we prepare folks in prison for nothing. Nothing awaits them when they are released. We've lost our right to be surprised that we have the highest recidivism rate in the country, in the state of California. So, and it's very frustrating, you know. My day is comprised of grown men sobbing in my office. I don't know what I'm going to do. No one will hire me. No one. I have to pay the rent on the first. I need Pampers today with nothing in the refrigerator. Grown men who, you know, just got out of prison. And of course, you know, what would we do if no one would hire us? You know, we get these endless faxes that say we have an opening, no felons. You go, well, okay, we'll find somebody without a felony, but it's, you know. So Homeboy Industries is a tiny drop in a fat bucket, though I would say it's, you know, touched a lot of lives of gang members in this county. But, you know, you really need the community at large to say, okay, I see what I can do. Nobody's asking you to transform your entire workforce into homies. You know, give me three slots. And if everybody did that, you know, and teach them. And they're eager and they'll really learn. And employers always say the same thing. They're nervous. I'm not so sure. Okay, we'll try it. And then they call me the next day and say, oh, my God, I had no idea. He's so eager. Send me somebody else like Carlos, you know. So you want that to happen, but we all have to do battle with our own preconceived notions of who these guys are until you meet them, and you can't demonize somebody you know, and you're trying to make that, accelerate that process of creating a community of kinship such that God might recognize it. So, but all hands on deck, people can employ, and if you can, I encourage you to do it. Or if you can't employ, you can write a check. Homeboy Industries, 130 West Bruno, 90012.
There's someone up here in the back there. Right. Right behind you, actually. She's had her hand up for a minute. Thank
you. This question is for Leslie. I'm curious, what got you involved in Homeboy Industries, how you ended up there? And then, not knowing much about your background, obviously you're a writer, a literary type person, once you got involved, how did you approach it? I mean, how did you even decide to walk into a room and look at these guys who, you know, didn't know poetry, didn't, you know, and reach out and get to touch them, figure out how to do that?
Well, before I had I'd come to Homeboy, I've been teaching for almost 10 years now in high school communities in East and Southeast LA and Compton, and in youth and gang intervention agencies. I've been doing that for a long time. So when I walked into Homeboy, on the one hand, it wasn't any different from some of the other work I'd done. On the other hand, I can't explain it, really. It was profoundly different in so many ways, and I think because that office is so filled with, really, with genuine hope, and there's so much joy in that place, aside from the sobbing, because there's a lot of that too. Myself included, by the way. I have my own meltdowns. But the way that I do it, well, first of all, this may be naive, but I just really believe that everybody deep down is a poet. I just really believe that, and that all it really takes is passion on my part, I guess, and a few good poems, and complete and total faith that they can pick it up, and that, and you know, they thrive in that environment. In some ways, I see some of my UCLA students, so don't take this the wrong way, but in some ways they thrive more, and I think because for them the stakes are so high. And they, you know, they just want to learn. They just want to be a part of the literary community. I do bring in, like I said, culturally relevant material. And, you know, I'm patient also. I know for a long time, like I said, Hector just did not believe me when I said he was a good writer. And he would go around the office going, I don't think Leslie's telling me the truth. And then everybody would tell me, you know, Hector doesn't think you're telling the truth. Because there's no secrets. And but you know what? He finally got it. You know, they finally pick it up. And I find, here's the bottom line for me. I think one of the things that Homeboy has really taught me, because when I first walked into Homeboy, you know, I had kind of stopped writing myself. I don't talk about this often, but I was in a really deep writer's block. I really had lost my faith that writing mattered. And what I saw happening in front of me and what I've seen in the last couple of years is people literally, literally transforming right before my eyes. They write a single sentence that opens up the possibility for forgiveness, something they might never have thought of, and they're changed. So for me, it's a kind of selfish act in a way, because it teaches me and reiterates for me on a daily basis that language and poetry does matter, and it brought me back to my own writing. You know, I hope that answered your question. But yeah, right here.
First of all, I want to thank you for all the work that you're doing, for giving hope to a community that is very repressed and very downcast, and we really need that hope in all communities. Second of all, I want to congratulate you for everything you've done and all the progress that you've done. I remember reading about Father Greg years ago in the LA Times, and I've always wanted to meet you, so I have this opportunity. And my question to you, Father, is how is it that you went from Loyola High School and ended up at Dolores Mission? Can you give us a story?
After I was ordained in 84, I went to Bolivia because I kind of wanted to work with the poor, or so I felt. And that was a real time of conversion for me. And that was after I had taught at Loyola High. Alan Martin is back there, compadre. And so that sort of changed my life. And I was supposed to go to Santa Clara and kind of do a work with the students there to help them do community service and serve in underserved communities. But it wasn't enough for me. So I asked my provincial if I could go to the poorest place we had. And it was Dolores Mission at the time. And I couldn't be happier that happened. So, and then now, you know, it's just, so there was a vocation within a vocation within a vocation, you know, it was Jesuit and working with the poor, speaking Spanish, and then discovering, you know, kind of folks on the margins, you know, the easily despised and the readily left out. And there's something for me that I feel deeply, and that's to, you want to kind of stand with the disposable and so that the moment will come when we stop throwing people away. And so it's about positioning. It's about location, location, location. It's about locating yourself exactly where the folks on the margins are, and all the while kind of tweaking the circle of compassion so that more folks get included, and ultimately nobody's left standing outside of that circle. So, you know, on the totem pole of value in our society, gang members are sort of at the lowest place. And you want to kind of say, well, there is no them. And unless you stand with them, you know, that never gets obliterated unless you actually stand there. So anyway, I loved my time at Loyola High. I taught there for 3 years. But, I mean, I couldn't be happier. Wouldn't trade my life for anybody's.
Hi, Father Gregory. Since we talk in Pasadena, I had this question in mind.
Oh, yeah.
Could you contrast the tattoo removal of your program versus what's taking place in the community, where it's taking over the community, legs, arms, heads, and everything else?
Well, I don't know if I can comment on tattoos getting put on. You know, maybe it's happening a lot, you know. But it's in our place, you know, our tattoo removal began, and again, kids close your ears, but it began with a guy named Frank who came into my office with "fuck the world" across his forehead, you know, and he said, you know, I'm having a hard time finding a job, you know. And suddenly I saw him, you know, at a drive-in window, "do you want fries with that," you know, and then imagining the car peeling away, you know. No. So we thought, wow, this might be an impediment, you know. And so we started tattoo removal because it evolved. And we never thought out to do it until truly we started to encounter things like that. And then, you know, and it's a way of sending a statement to both friend and enemy that, yeah, this is a new life for me now. I don't want any part of that. We have always had thousands of different stories of homies coming in. I said, well, and we always ask them, why do you want your tattoos removed? And a homie came in, he said, because I caught my kid today with a marker pen marking his arms. I want all these off. It takes what it takes. Once a kid had written on a thing, because I want to move around safely. And he was called a month later to be reminded of his appointment in April, and his girlfriend said he was killed 2 weeks before. So it's significant. There was a group in our office today visiting who run a tattoo removal program, and they have all these requisites and requirements, rather, and community service, and we don't have any of that because we think it's so significant when somebody steps up and says, I want this off. We don't want anything to impede that but the natural waiting that comes when you have a waiting list of 1,000 people. So
we have time for one more, and there's a lady in the back who's had her hand up, I think, for a while. Yeah.
I'd just like to give you all a compliment. You make the best cookies in town.
Wait, I don't think we caught all of that. What was that?
I said, I want to give you all a compliment. I think you all make the best cookies in town.
Yeah. We wanted a complete sentence for the podcast, so thank you.
Okay, we do have time for one more. I'm not looking on this side. Is there anyone over here? Yes, okay. You, right here in the front, yeah. Okay.
How do you guys feel, I mean, Hector and Augustine, now that you've, you know, this was 16, 17 years ago, you've lived this life, how do you guys feel now? I mean, you know, you've transformed your life. Do you guys, you know, want to see the homies? Do you guys go around the block to see them? I mean, how do you guys feel?
I feel, you know what, today I've never had a father in my life, seriously, and to me, like, once I left that behind, I left it complete, like, 100% to me, like, it's there, right? Whatever happens there is there to me. I don't look back. I'm just looking forward now and continue to look forward. And I just want to heal from all the deep wounds that I carry inside of me, and that there's a lot of that I carry. And I just want to be the greatest fathers to my two little kids that are in the front right now, so. And that's what I live for today, so.
I feel, you know, like totally blessed to come, you know, to come, of course, to come to Homeboys. I still have friends that are in the neighborhood. I go visit my mom and stuff, say what's up to the fellas, you know. Hey, what's going on? These are guys I went to elementary school with and stuff, you know. I don't diss them, you know. Hey, I tell them, you know, hey, you work with Homeboy Industries, huh? Yeah, I do, brother. The doors are open. And Jesus hired a lot of people, you know, that come in from the area that I'm from. And I you know, I lived a life. By God's grace, I made it here. And you know, the wounds that I've had, you know, mentally and stuff, I use them for the better of helping friends and my brothers and sisters that come into Homeboys due to the experiences that I've dealt with. And it's just, I thank God. Like, I thank God daily. You have no idea of how blessed that I really am, you know, to be where I'm at right now. It's unbelievable. I couldn't write this, you know what I mean? So, it's cool, man. Everything is great.
Thank you so much for coming tonight. There's some information about the Homeboy Press, which we didn't really get a chance to talk about, but, you know, there's information out there on the... We'll do another event. We'll do another event, Luis says. Yeah. And there's also... This is for Mona's benefit. There's donation envelopes out there and all kinds of other information. So thank you all for coming tonight.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.